The most dangerous man in the world should be introduced. He has never, in his entire life, harmed a living creature. He has dissected a few, but only after they were dead, and had marveled at how well they'd been put together, considering it had been done by unskilled labor. For several years, he hadn't moved outside a large, airy room. But this was okay, because he spent most of his time inside his own head, in any case. There's a certain type of person it's very hard to imprison. He had, however, surmised that an hour's exercise every day was essential for a healthy appetite and proper bowel movements, and was currently sitting on a machine of his own invention. It consisted of a saddle above a pair of treadles, which churned, by means of a chain, a large wooden wheel currently held off the ground on a metal stand. Another freewheeling wooden wheel was positioned in front of the saddle and could be turned by means of a tiller arrangement. He'd fitted the extra wheel and tiller so that he could wheel the entire thing over to the wall when he'd finished taking his exercise, and besides, it gave the whole thing a pleasing symmetry. He called it the turning the wheel with pedals and another wheel machine. Lord Veterinary was also at work. Normally, he was in the oblong office, or seated in his plain wooden chair at the foot of the steps in the palace of Ankh-Morpork, which was an ornate throne at the top of the steps, covered with dust. It was the throne of Ankh-Morpork, and was, indeed, made of gold. He'd never dreamed of sitting on it. But it was a nice day. So he is working in the garden. Visitors of Ankh-Morpork were often surprised to find that there were some interesting gardens attached to the patrician's palace. The patrician was not a gardens kind of person, but some of the his predecessors had been, and Lord Veterinary never changed or destroyed anything if there was no logical reason to do so. He maintained the little zoo and the racehorse stable, and even recognized that the gardens themselves were of extreme historic interest, because this was so obviously the case. They have been laid out by Bloody Stupid Johnson. Many great landscape gardeners have gone down in history and been remembered in a very solid way by the magnificent parks and gardens that they designed with almost godlike powers and foresight, thinking nothing of making lakes and shifting hills and planting woodlands to enable future generations to appreciate the sublime beauty of wild nature transformed by man. There have been Capability Brown, Sagacity Smith, Intuition de Vere Sladgor. In Ankh-Morpork, there have been Bloody Stupid Johnson. Bloody Stupid, it might look a bit messy now, but just you come back in 500 years' time, Johnson. Bloody Stupid, look, the plans were the right way round when I drew them, Johnson. Bloody Stupid Johnson, who had 2,000 tons of earth built into an artificial hillock in front of Quorum Manor, because it'd drive me mad to have to look at a bunch of trees and mountains all day long. How about you? The Ankh-Morpork Palace grounds were considered the high spot of, if such it could be called, of his career. For example, they contained the ornamental trout lake, 150 yards long, and because of one of those trifling errors of notation that were such a distinctive feature of Bloody Stupid's designs, 1 inch wide, it was the home of one trout, which was quite comfortable, provided it didn't try to turn around, and had once featured an ornate fountain, which, when first switched on, did nothing but groan ominously for 5 minutes and then fire a small cherub 1,000 feet into the air. It contained the ho-ho, which was like a ha-ha, only deeper. A ha-ha is a concealed ditch and wall designed to allow landowners to look out across rolling vistas without getting cattle and inconvenient poor people wandering across the lands. The lawns. Under Bloody Stupid's errant pencil, it was dug 50 feet deep and had claimed 3 gardeners already. The maze was so small, the people got lost looking for it. And the patrician rather liked the gardens in a quiet kind of way. He had certain views about the mentality of most of mankind, and the gardens made him feel fully justified. Piles of paper were stacked on the lawn around the chair. Clerks renewed them or took them away periodically. They were different clerks. All sorts and types of information flowed into the palace, but there was only one place where it all came together. Very much like strands of gossamer coming together in the center of a web. A great many rulers, good and bad and quite often dead, know what happened. A rare few actually manage, by dint of much effort, to know what's happening. Lord Ventnor considered both types to lack ambition. "Yes, Dr. Crucis," he said, without looking up. "How the hell does he do it?" Gracious wondered. "I know I didn't make any noise." "Ah, Havelock," he began. "You have something to tell me, Doctor. It's been mislaid, yes, and no doubt you are anxiously seeking it. Very well, good day." The patrician hadn't moved his head the whole time. He hadn't even bothered to ask what it was. He bloody well knows, thought Crucis. How is it you can never tell him anything he doesn't know? Lord Ventnor put down a piece of paper on one of the piles and picked up another. "You're still here, Dr. Crucis. I can assure you, my lord, that..." I'm sure you can. There's one question that intrigues me, however. "My lord, why was it in your guild house to be stolen? I had been given to understand it had been destroyed. I'm quite sure I gave orders." This was the question the assassin had been hoping would not be asked. But the patrician was good at that game. That is, my predecessor thought it should serve as a warning and an example. The patrician looked up and smiled brightly. "Capital," he said. "I've always had a great belief in the effectiveness of examples, so I'm sure you'll be able to sort this out with minimum inconvenience all around." "Certainly, my lord," said the assassin glumly. "But..." Noon began. Noon and Ankh-Morpork took some time, since 12 o'clock was established by consensus. Generally, the first bell to start was that one in the Teachers' Guild, in response to the universal prayers of its members. Then the water clock on the Temple of Small Gods would trigger. The big bronze gong, the black bell in the Temple of Fate, struck once, unexpectedly, but by then the silver-pedal-driven carillon in the Fool's Guild would be tinkling. The gongs, the bells, and chimes of the guilds and temples would be in full swing, and it was impossible to tell them apart, except for the tongueless and magical octron bell of old Tom in the unseen university clock tower, whose 12 measured silences temporarily overruled the din. And finally, several strokes behind all the others, was the bell of the Assassin's Guild, which was always last. Beside the patrician, the ornamental sundial chimed twice and fell over. "You were saying?" said the patrician mildly. "Captain Vimes," said Dr. Crucis. "He's taking an interest. Dear me. But it is his job. Really? I must demand that you call him off." The words echoed around the garden. Several pigeons flew away. "Demand," said the patrician sweetly. Dr. Crucis backed and filled desperately. "He is a servant, after all," he said. "I see no reason why he should be allowed to involve himself in affairs that don't concern him." "I rather believe he thinks he's a servant of the law," said the patrician. "He's a jack in office, and an insolent upstart. Dear me, I did not appreciate your strength of feeling, but since you demand it, I'll bring him to heel without delay. Thank you. Don't mention it. Do not let me keep you." Dr. Crucis wandered off in the direction of the patrician's idle gesture. Lord Ventnor bent over his paperwork again, and did not even look up when there was a distant, muffled cry. Instead, he reached down and rang a small silver bell. A clerk hurried up. "Go and fetch the ladder, will you, Drumknot?" he said. "Dr. Crucis seems to have fallen in the ho-ho." The back door to the dwarf Bjorn Hammerhawk's workshop lifted off the latch and creaked open. He went to see if there was anyone there, and shivered. He shut the door. Bit of a chilly breeze, he said, to the room's other occupant. Still, we could do with it. We could do with it. The ceiling of the workshop was only about 5 feet above the floor. That was more than tall enough for a dwarf. Ow, said a voice that no one heard. Hammerhawk looked at the thing clamped in the vise and picked up a screwdriver. Ow. Amazing, he said. I think that moving this tube down the barrel forces the ear 6 chambers to slide along, presenting a new one to the ear firing hole. That seems clear enough. The triggering mechanism is really just a tinderbox device. The spring here has rusted, though. I can easily replace that, you know, he said, looking up. This is a very interesting device, with the chemicals in the tubes and all. Such a simple idea. Is it a clown thing? Some kind of automatic slapstick? He sorted through a bin of metal offcuts and to find a piece of steel, and then selected a file. I'd like to make a few sketches afterwards, he said. About 30 seconds later, there was a pop and a cloud of smoke. Bjorn Hammerhawk picked himself up, shaking his head. That was lucky, he said. Could have been a nasty accident there. He tried to fan some of the smoke away, and then reached for the file again. And his hand went through it. Ahem. Bjorn tried again. The file was as unsubstantial as the smoke. What? Ahem. The owner of the strange device was staring in horror at something on the floor. Bjorn followed his gaze. Oh, he said. Realization, which had been hovering at the edge of Bjorn's consciousness, finally dawned. That was the thing about death. When it happened to you, you were among the first to know. His visitor grabbed the device from the bench and rammed it into a cloth bag. Then he looked around wildly, picked up the corpse of Mr. Hammerhawk, and dragged it through the door towards the river. There was a distant splash, or as close to a splash as you could get from the Ankh. Oh dear, said Bjorn. And I can't swim either. That will not, of course, be a problem, said Death. Bjorn looked at him. You're a lot shorter than I thought you'd be, he said. This is because I'm kneeling down, Mr. Hammerhawk. That damn thing killed me.
Yes. That's the first time anything like that has ever happened to me. To anyone, but not, I suspect, the last time. Death stood up. There was a clicking of knee joints. He no longer cracked his skull on the ceiling. There wasn't a ceiling anymore. The room had gently faded away. There were such things as dwarf gods. Dwarfs were not a naturally religious species, but in a world where pit props could crack without warning, and pockets of fire damp could suddenly explode, they'd seen the need for gods as the sort of supernatural equivalent of a hard hat. Besides, when you hit your thumb with an 8-pound hammer, it's nice to be able to blaspheme. It takes a very special and strong-minded kind of atheist to jump up and down with their hand clasped under their other armpit and shout, "Oh, random fluctuations in the space-time continuum!" Or, "Arg, primitive and outmoded concept on a crutch!" Bjorn didn't waste time asking questions. A lot of things become a shade urgent when you're dead. I believe in reincarnation, he said. I know. I tried to live a good life. Does that help? That is not up to me, Death coughed. Of course, since you believe in reincarnation, you'll be Bjorn again. He waited. Yes, that's right, said Bjorn. Dwarfs are known for their sense of humor. In a way, people point them out and say, those little devils haven't got a sense of humor. Was there anything amusing in the statement I just made? No. No, I don't think so. It was a pun, or play on words. Bjorn again. Yes? Did you notice it? I can't say I did. Oh, sorry. I've been told I should try to make the occasion a little more enjoyable. Bjorn again. Yes. I'll think about it. Thank you. Right, said Sergeant Cullen. This, men, is your truncheon. It has also nomenclatured your nightstick or baton of office. He paused while he tried to remember his army delays, days. He brushes up. And you will look after it, he shouted. You will eat with it. You will sleep with it. You, excuse me, who said that? Down here, it's me, Lance Constable Cuddy. Yes, Pilgrim? How do we eat with it, Sergeant? Sergeant Collins wound up machismo, would wound down. He was suspicious of Lance Constable Cuddy. He strongly suspected Lance Constable Cuddy was a troublemaker. What? Well, do we use it as a knife or a fork or cut in half for chopsticks or what? What are you talking about? Excuse me, Sergeant. What is it, Lance Constable Inqua? How exactly do we sleep with it, sir? Well, I meant... Corporal Nob, stop that sniggering right now. Colin adjusted his breastplate and decided to strike out in a new direction. Now, what we have here is a puppet moment or effigy. Indicating a vaguely humanoid shape made of leather and stuffed with straw, mounted on a stake, called by the nickname of Arthur. Weapons training. For this use of. For Lance Constable Angua. Tell me, Lance Constable, do you think you could kill a man? How long will I have? There was a pause while they picked up Corporal Knobs and patted him on the back until he settled down. Very well, said Sergeant Cullen. What you must do now is take your truncheon like so, and on the command one, proceed smartly to Arthur, and on the command two, tap him smartly upon the bounce. One, two. The truncheon bounced off Arthur's helmet. Very good. Only one thing wrong. Anyone tell me what it was? They shook their heads. From behind, said Sergeant Cullen. You hit him from behind. No sense in risking trouble, is there? Now you have a go, Lance Constable Cuddy. But, Sarge, do it. They watched. Perhaps we could fetch him a chair, said Angua, after an embarrassing 15 seconds, to try to snigger. Him too little to be a guard, he said. Lance Constable Cuddy stopped, jumping up and down. Sorry, Sergeant, he said. This isn't how dwarfs do it, see? It's how guards do it, said Sergeant Cullen. All right, Lance Constable Detritus, don't salute. You give it a try. Detritus held the truncheon between what must technically be called thumb and forefinger and smashed it over Arthur's helmet. He stared reflectively at the truncheon stump. Then he bunched up his, for want of a better word, fist, and hammered Arthur over what was briefly its head until the stake was driven 3 feet into the ground. Now the dwarf, he said. He can have a go, he said. There was another embarrassed 5 seconds. Sergeant Cullen cleared his throat. Well, yes, I think we can consider him thoroughly apprehended, he said. Make a note, Corporal Knobs. Lance Constable Detritus. Don't salute. Deducted $1 for loss of truncheon. And you're supposed to be able to ask him questions afterwards. He looked at the remains of Arthur. I think around now is a good time to demonstrate the fine points of archery, he said. Lady Sybil Ramkin looked at the sad strip of leather that was all that remained of the late Chubby. Who'd do something like this to a poor little dragon, he said. She said. We're trying to find out, said Vimes. We think maybe he was tied up next to a wall and exploded. Carrot leaned over the wall of a pen. Coochie coochie coo, he said, as friendly flames took his eyebrows off. I mean, he was as tame as anything, said Lady Ramkin. Wouldn't hurt a fly, poor little thing. How could someone make a dragon blow up, said Vimes. Could you do it by giving it a kick? Oh, yes, said Sybil. You'd lose your leg, mind you. Then it wasn't that. Any other way? So you wouldn't get hurt? Not really. It'd be easier to make it blow itself up. Really, Sam. I don't like talking about it. I have to know. Well, at this time of year, the males fight. Make themselves look big, you know. That's why I always keep them apart. Vimes shook his head. There was only one dragon, he said. Behind them, Carrot leaned over the next pen, where a pear-shaped male dragon opened one eye and glared at him. Who's a good boy, then? Muttered Carrot. I'm sure I've got a bit of coal somewhere. The dragon opened the other eye, blinked, and then was fully awake and rearing up, its ears flattened, its nostrils flared, its wings unfurled. It breathed in. From its stomach came the gurgle of rushing acids as sluices and valves were opened. Its feet left the floor. Its chest expanded. Vimes hit Carrot at waist height, burying him to the ground. In its pen, the dragon blinked. The enemy had mysteriously gone, scared off. It subsided, blowing off a huge flame. Vimes unclasped his hands from his head and rolled over. What did you do that for, Captain? Said Kara. It was attacking a dragon, shouted Vimes. One that wouldn't back down. He pulled himself to his knees and tapped Carrot's breastplate. You polished that up real bright, he said. You can see yourself in it. So can anyone else. Oh, yes, of course, there's that, said Lady Sybil. Everyone knows you should keep dragons away from mirrors. Mirrors, said Carrot. Hey, there are bits of... Yes, he showed Chubby a mirror, said Vimes. The poor little thing must have been trying to make himself bigger than himself, said Carrot. We're dealing here, said Vimes, with a twisted mind. Oh, no, you think so? Yes. But, no, you can't be right, because Nobby was with us all the time. Not Nobby, said Vimes testily. Whatever he might do to a dragon, I doubt if he'd make it explode. There are stranger people in this world than Corporal Knobs, my lad. Carrot's expression slid into a rictus of intrigued horror. Gosh, he said. Sergeant Cullen surveyed the butts. Then he removed his helmet and wiped his forehead. I think perhaps Lance Constable Angwad shouldn't have another go with the longbow until we've worked out how to stop her getting in the way. Sorry, Sergeant. They turned to Detritus, who was standing sheepishly behind a heap of broken longbows. Crossbows were out of the question. They sat in his massive hands like a hairpin. In theory, the longbow would be a deadly weapon in his hands, just as soon as he mastered the art of when to let go. Detritus shrugged. Sorry, mister, he said. Bows aren't troll weapon. Ha, said Cullen. As for you, Lance Constable Cuddy, just can't get the hang of aiming, Sergeant. I thought dwarves were famous for their skills in battle. Yeah, but not these skills, said Cuddy. Ambush, muttered Detritus. Since he was a troll, the murmur bounced off distant buildings. Cuddy's beard bristled. You devious troll, I get my... Well now, said Sergeant Cullen quickly. I think we'll stop training. You'll have to sort of pick it up as you go along, all right? He sighed. He was not a cruel man, but he'd been either a soldier or a guard all his life, and he was feeling put upon. Otherwise, he wouldn't have seen what... Otherwise, he wouldn't have said what he said next. I don't know. I really don't. Fighting among yourselves, smashing your weapons. I mean, who do we think we're fooling? Now, it's nearly noon. You take a few hours off. We'll see you again tonight, if you think it's worth turning up. There was a spang noise. Cuddy's crossbow had gone off in his hands. The bolt whiffled past Corporal Knobs' ear and landed in the river, where it stuck. Sorry, said Cuddy. Tisk, tisk, said Sergeant Cullen. That was the worst part. It would have been better all around if he called the dwarf some names. It would have been better if he made it seem that Cuddy was worth an insult. He turned around and walked off towards Sidopolis Yard. They heard his muttered comment. What him say, said Detritus. A fine body of men, said Angua, going red. Cuddy spat at the ground, which didn't take long to on account of its closeness. Then he reached under his cloak and produced, like a conjurer extracting a size 10 rabbit from a size 5 hat, his double-headed battle axe and started to run. By the time he reached the virginal target, he was a blur. There was a rip and the dummy exploded like a nuclear haystack. The other two wandered up and inspected the result as pieces of chaff gently drifted to the ground. Yes, all right, said Angua. They did say you're supposed to be able to ask them questions afterwards. He didn't say they've got to be able to answer them, said Cuddy grimly. Lance Constable Cuddy, deduct $1 for target, said Detritus, who already owed $11 for bows. If it's worth turning up, said Cubby, losing the axe somewhere about his person again. Speciesist. I don't think he meant it that way, said Thangwa. Oh, it's all right for you, said Cuddy. Why? Because you're a man, said the Tritus. Angua was bright enough to pause for a moment to think this over. A woman, she said. Same thing, only in broad terms. Come on, let's go and have a drink. The transient moment of camaraderie and adversity completely evaporated. Drink with a troll. Drink with a dwarf. All right, said Angua. How about you and you coming and having a drink with me? Angua removed her helmet and shook out her hair. Female trolls don't have hair, although the more fortunate ones are able to cultivate a fine growth of lichen, and a female dwarf is more likely to be complimented on the silkiness of her beard than on her scalp. But it was just possible the sight of Angua scraped some little sparks off some shared and ancient cosmic maleness. I haven't really had a chance to look around, she said, but I saw a place in Gleam Street, which meant they had to cross the river, at least two of them trying to indicate to passers-by that they weren't with at least one of the other two, which meant that, with desperate nonchalance, they were looking around, which meant that Cuddy saw the dwarf in the water. If you could call it water. If you could still call it a dwarf. They looked down. You know, said Detritus after a while, that looked like that dwarf who make weapons in Rhyme Street. Bjorn Hammerhawk, said Cuddy. That the one, yeah. It looks a bit like him, Cuddy conceded, still taking in a cold, talking in a cold flat voice. But not exactly like him. What you mean, said Angua. Because Mr. Hammerhawk, said Cuddy, didn't have such a great big hole where his chest should be. Doesn't he ever sleep, thought Vimes. Doesn't the bloody man ever get his head down? Isn't there a room somewhere with a black dressing gown hanging on the door? He knocked in at the door of the oblong office. Ah, Captain, said the patrician, looking up from his paperwork. You were commendably quick, was I? You got my message, said Lord Venner. No, sir, I've been occupied. Indeed, and what could occupy you? Someone has killed Mr. Hammerhawk, sir. A big man in the dwarf community. He's been shot with something, some kind of siege weapon or something, and dumped in the river. We've just fished him out. I was on the way to tell his wife. I think he lives in Treacle Street. And I thought, since I was passing, this is very unfortunate. Certainly it was for Mr. Hammerhawk, said Vimes. The patrician leaned back and stared at Vimes. Tell me, he said. How was he killed?
I don't know.
I've never seen anything like it. There was just a great big hole. But I'm going to find out what it was. Did I mention that Dr. Crucis came to see me this morning? No, sir. He was very concerned. Yes, sir. I think you upset him. Sir? The patrician seemed to be reaching a decision. His chair thumped forward. Captain Vimes. Sir? I know you are retiring the day after tomorrow and feel, therefore, a little restless. But you are captain of the night watch. I am asking you to follow very specific instructions, sir. You'll cease any investigations connected with this theft from the Assassin's Guild. Do you understand? It is entirely guild business. Sir, Vimes kept his face carefully immobile. I'm choosing to believe that the unspoken word in that sentence was a yes, Captain. Sir? The patrician seemed to be reaching a decision. Sir. And that one, too. As for the matter of the unfortunate Mr. Hammerhawk, the body was discovered just a short while ago. Yes, sir. Then it's out of your jurisdiction, Captain. What? Sir? The day watch can deal with it. But we've never bothered with that hours of daylight jurisdiction stuff. Nevertheless, in the current circumstances, I shall instruct Captain Quirk to take over the investigation, if it turns out that one is necessary. If one is necessary, if people don't end up with half their chest gone by accident. Meteorite strike, perhaps, thought Vimes. He took a deep breath and leaned on the patrician's desk. Mayonnaise Quark couldn't find his arse with an atlas, and he's got no idea about how to talk to dwarfs. He calls them grit suckers. My men found the body. It's my jurisdiction. The patrician glanced at Vimes' hands. Vimes removed them from the desk as if it had suddenly grown red hot. Night watch, that's what you are, Captain. Your writ runs in the hours of darkness. It's dwarfs we're talking about. If we don't get it right, they'll take the law into their own hands. That usually means chopping the head off the nearest troll. And you'll put Quark on this. I've given you an order, Captain, but you may go. You can't. I said you may go, Captain Vimes. Sir? Sir! Vimes saluted. Then he turned about and marched out of the room. He closed the door carefully so that there was barely a click. The patrician heard him thump the wall outside. Vimes was unaware, but there was a number of barely perceptible dents in the wall outside the oblong office, their depths corresponding to his emotional state at the time. By the sound of it, this one would need the service of a plasterer. Lord Veterinary permitted himself a smile, although there was no humor in it. The city operated. It was a self-regulating college of guilds, linked by the inexorable laws of mutual self-interest, and it worked, on average, by and large, overall, normally. The last thing you needed was some watchman blundering around upsetting things, like a loose siege catapult. Normally. Vimes seemed in a suitable emotional state. With any luck, the orders would have the desired effect.
There is a bar like it in every big city. It's where the coppers drink. The guards seldom drank in Ankh-Morpork's more cheerful taverns when they were off duty. It was too easy to see something that would put them back on duty again. So they generally went to the Bucket in Gleam Street. It was small and low-ceilinged, and the presence of city guards tended to discourage other drinkers. But Mr. Cheese, the owner, wasn't too worried about this. No one drinks like a copper who has seen too much to stay sober. Carrot counted out his change on the counter. That's 3 beers, 1 milk, 1 molten sulfur on Coke.
With phosphoric acid.
With umbrellas in it, said Detritus. And a slow, comfortable double entendre with lemonade.
With a fruit salad in it, said Nobby.
Woof!
And some beer in a bowl, said Angua. That little dog seems to have taken quite a shine to you, said Carrot.
Yes, said Angua. I can't think why.
The drinks were put in front of them. They stared at the drinks. They drank the drinks.
Mr. Cheese, who knew coppers, wordlessly refilled the glasses in Detritus's insulated mug. They stared at the drinks. They drank the drinks.
You know, said Cullen after a while, what really gets me, is they just dumped him in the water. I mean, not even weights, just dumped him. Like it didn't matter if he was found. You know what I mean?
What gets me, said Cuddy, is that he was a dwarf.
What gets me is that he was murdered, said Carrot.
Mr. Cheese passed along the line again. They stared at the drinks. They drank the drinks.
Because the fact was that, despite all evidence to the contrary, murder was not a commonplace occurrence in Ankh-Morpork. There were, it was true, assassinations. And as aforesaid, there were many ways one could inadvertently commit suicide. And there were occasional domestic fracas on a Saturday night as people sought a cheaper alternative to divorce. There were all these things, but at least they had a reason, however unreasonable.
Big man in the dwarfs, was Mr. Hammerhock, said Carrot.
A good citizen, too. Wasn't always stirring up old trouble like Mr. Strong in the arm.
He's got a workshop in Rhyme Street, said Nobby.
Had, said Sergeant Cullen.
They stared at the drinks.
They drank the drinks.
What I want to know is, said Angua, what put that hole in him?
Never see anything like that, said Colin. Hadn't someone better go and tell Mrs. Hammerhock, said Anqua. Captain Vimes is doing it, said Carrot. He said he wouldn't ask anyone else to do it. Rather him than me, said Colin fervently. I wouldn't do that for a big clock. They can be fearsome when they're angry, those little buggers. Everyone nodded gloomily, including the little bugger and the bigger little bugger by adoption. They stared at the drinks. They drank the drinks. Shouldn't we be finding out who did it, said Angua. Why, said Nami. She opened and shut her mouth once or twice, and finally came out with, in case they do it again. It wasn't an assassination, was it, said Cuddy. No, said Carrot. They always leave a note, by law. They looked at the drinks. They drank the drinks. What a city, said Angua. It all works. That's the funny thing, said Carrot. Do you know, when I first joined the watch, I was so simple, I arrested the head of the Thieves Guild for thieving. Sounds good to me, said Angua. Got into a bit of trouble for that, said Carrot. You see, said Colin, thieves are organized here. I mean, it's official. They're allowed a certain amount of thieving. Not that they do much these days, mind you. If you pay them a little premium every year, they give you a card and leave you alone. Saves time and effort all around. And all thieves are members, said Angua. Oh, yes, said Carrot. Can't go thieving in Ankh-Morpork without a guild permit. Not unless you've got a special talent. Why, what happens? What talent, she said. Well, like being able to survive being hung upside down from one of the gates with your ears nailed up to your knees. Nailed to your knees, said Carrot. Angua said, that's terrible. Yes, I know, but the thing is, said Carrot, the thing is, it works. The whole thing. Guilds and organized crime and crimes and everything. It all seems to work. Didn't work for Mrs. Hammerhock, said Sergeant Colin. They looked at their drinks. Very slowly, like a mighty sequoia beginning the first step towards resurrection, out as a million save the trees leaflets. Detritus toppled backward, with his mug still in his hand. Apart from the 90-degree change in position, he didn't move a muscle. It's the sulfur, said Cuddy, without looking around. It goes right to their heads. Carrot thumped his fist on the bar. We ought to do something. We could nick the boots, said Nobby. I mean about Mr. Hammerhock. Oh, yeah, said Nami. You sound like old Vimesy. If we was to worry about every dead body in this town. But not like this, snapped Carrot. Normally, it's just, well, suicide or guild fighting. Stuff like that. But he was just a dwarf, pillar of the community. Spent all day making swords and axes and burial weapons and crossbows and torture implements. And then he's in the river with a great big hole in his chest. Who's going to do anything about it, if not us? You've been putting anything in your milk, said Colin. Look, the dwarfs can sort it out. It's like Quarry Lane. Don't stick your nose where someone can pull it off and eat it. We're the city watch, said Carrot. That doesn't mean that just that part of the city, who happens to be over 4 feet tall and made of flesh. No dwarf did it, said Cuddy, who was swaying gently. No troll neither. He tried to tap the side of his nose and missed. The reason being, he still has all his arms and legs on. Captain Vimes will want it investigated, said Carrot. Captain Vimes is trying to learn to be a civilian, said Nobby. Well, I'm going to, Colin began, and got off his stool. He jumped up and down a bit, his mouth opening and shutting. Then the words managed to come out. My foot! What about your foot? Something's stuck in it. He hopped backward, clutching at one sandal, and fell over detritus. "You'd be amazed what can get stuck in your boot in this town," said Carrot. "There's something on the bottom of your sandal," said Angua. "Stop waving it about, silly man." She drew her dagger. "Bit of card or something, with a drawing pin in it. You picked it up somewhere. Probably took a while for you to tread it through. There. Bit of card," said Carrot. "There's something written on it." Angua scraped away the mud. "Gun." "What does that mean?" she said. "I don't know. Something's gone, I suppose. But perhaps it's Mr. Gunn's visiting card." "Which, whoever he is," said Nami. "Who cares? Let's have a Carrot took the card and turned it over and over in his hands. "Save the pen," said Cuddy. You only get five of them for a penny. My cousin Gimmick makes them." "This is important," said Carrot slowly. "The captain ought to know about this. I think he was looking for it." "What's important about it?" said Sergeant Cullen. "Apart from my foot hurting like blazes." "I don't know. The captain will know," said Carrot stubbornly. "You tell him, then," said Cullen. "He's staying up at her ladyship's now." "Learning to be a gentleman," said Nobby. "I'm going to tell him," said Carrot. Angua glanced through the grubby window. The moon would be up soon. That was one trouble with cities. The damn thing could be lurking behind a tower if you weren't careful. "And I'd better be getting back to my lodgings," she said. "I'll accompany you," said Carrot quite quickly. "I ought to go and find Captain Vimes in any case." "It'll be out of your way. Honestly, I'd like to." She looked at his earnest expression. "I couldn't put you to the trouble," she said. "That's all right. I like walking. That helps me think." Angua smiled, despite her desperation. They stepped out into the softer heat of the evening. Instinctively, Carrot settled into the policeman's pace. "Very old street, this," he said. "They say there's an underground stream under it. I read that. What do you think?" "Do you really like walking?" said Angua, falling into step. "Oh, yes. There are many interesting byways and historical buildings to be seen. I often go for walks on my day off." She looked at his face. "You got," she thought. Why did you join the watch?" she said. "My father said it'd make a man of me." "It seems to have worked."
"Yes, it's the best job there is." "Really? Oh, yes. Do you know what policeman means?" Angua shrugged. "No." "It means man of the polis. That's an old word for city." "Yes?" "I read it in a book. Man of the city." She glanced sideways at him again. His face glowed in the light of a torch on the street corner, but it had some inner glow of its own. "He's proud," she remembered the oath. "Proud of being in the damn watch, for God's sake. Why did you join?" he said. "Me? Oh, I like to eat meals and sleep indoors. Anyways, there isn't that much choice, is there? It was that or become, a seamstress. And you're not very good at sewing?" Angua's sharp glance saw nothing but honest innocence in his face. "Yes," she said, giving up. "That's right. And then I saw this poster. The city watch needs men. Be a man in the city watch. So I thought I'd give it a go. After all, I'd only have something to gain." She waited to see if he'd fail to pick this one up, too. He did. "Sergeant Cullen wrote the notice," said Carrot. "He's a fairly direct thinker." He sniffed. "Can you smell something?" he said. "Smells like a bit like someone's thrown away an old privy carpet." "Oh, thank you very much," said a voice very low down, somewhere in the darkness. "Oh, yes, thank you very much. That's a very what's name of you. Old privy carpet. Oh, yes. Can't smell anything," Angua lied. "Liar," said the voice, "or hear anything." Captain Vimes' boots told him that he was in Schoon Avenue.
His feet were doing the walking of their own volition. His mind was somewhere else. In fact, some of it was dissolving gently in Jimkin Bear Hugger's finest nectar. If only they hadn't been so damn polite. There were a number of things he'd seen in his life which he'd always try, without success, to forget. Up until now, he would have put at the top of the list, looking at the tonsils of a giant dragon as it drew the breath instead of intended to churn him into a small pile of impure charcoal. He still woke up, sweating at the memory of the little pilot light. But he dreaded now that it was going to be replaced by the recollection of all those impassive dwarf faces watching him politely, and the feeling that his words were dropping into a deep pit. After all, what could he say? Sorry, he's dead, and that's official. We're putting our worst men on the case. The last Bjorn Hammerhawk's house had been full of dwarfs. Silent, owlish, polite dwarfs. The news had got around. He wasn't telling anyone anything they didn't know. Many of them were holding weapons. Mr. Strong in the Arm was there. Captain Vimes had talked to him before about his speeches on the subject of the need for grinding all trolls into little bits and using them to make roads. But the dwarf wasn't saying anything new. He was just looking smug. There was an air of quiet, polite menace that said, "We'll listen to you. Then we'll do what we decide to do." He hadn't even been sure which one was Mrs. Hammerhawk. They all looked alike to him. When she was introduced, helmeted, bearded, he'd got polite, noncommittal answers. No, she'd locked his workshop and seemed to have mislaid the key. Thank you. He'd tried to indicate as subtly as possible that a wholesale march on Quarry Lane would be frowned upon by the guard, probably from a vantage point of at a safe distance, but hadn't the face to spell it out. He couldn't say, "Don't take matters into your own hands, for the guard are mighty in pursuit of the wrongdoer." Mightily in pursuit of the wrongdoer. Because he didn't have a clue where to start. Had your husband any enemies? Yes. Someone put a great hole in him. But apart from that, did he have any enemies? So he'd extracted himself with as much dignity as possible, which wasn't very much, and after a battle with himself which he'd lost, he'd picked up half a bottle of Bear Hugger's old persnickety and wandered into the night.